Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
about us. Welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly. My name is Daryl Clark, and you're at the right place at the right time. Welcome to Earth Week. Today was Earth Day. And so that song being so apropos for those of you who, the few of you, don't recognize that iconic voice, that's right, none other than the late, great Michael Jackson singing his Earth song. What about Sunrise? Truly, say what you will about the brother, definitely ahead of his time. Definitely ahead of his time. I mean, just look at some of the lyrics on some of his songs, especially when he was, starting to get into more of the activism type work. But this, one of my favorites, Earth Song, some of the lyrics, just perfect. What have we done to the world? Look what we've done. What about all the peace, your pledge, your only son? Wow, man, this guy. You know, so look those lyrics up, folks. This was truly, I believe, one of his greater works that he did. Just as I said, perusing, you know, some of the lyrics, just a beautiful piece. But back to this piece of work that we're doing tonight on Progressive News Weekly, as we need to do, and I suggest, put on your seatbelts. Tonight will be another hold-on type of a program. As I said, this is Earth Week. Yesterday was Earth Day. This is Earth Month. And, you know, like Black History Month, as far as I'm concerned, every day is Earth Day, and every month is Earth Month. But, you know, just to give it that special celebration, we always do something special in the month of April. And so with that said, this month is no exception. This evening, for those of you who are on the mail list, you know what I'm talking about. We have a very, very special guest. And it is a special treat for me because the organization from which this guest comes from was a partner that goes back many, many years to the earlier Progressive News Weekly days. Some 8-9 years ago, they usually had someone to join us from their organization. And I'm talking about the National Wildlife Federation. Many of you probably know what I'm talking about, and some of you don't. National Wildlife Federation is basically an environmentally friendly organization that's been around for numerous decades. We're going to get into some of the background of the National Wildlife Federation. But this evening, we have a special guest that will be joining us. Dr. Bruce Stein, and he actually is the chief, the lead, the top dog scientist at the National Wildlife Federation, and he's also the associate vice president of National Wildlife Federation. So we have somewhat of a heavy hitter joining us this evening, and I'm just pleasingly proud to say that he's going to be right here with us talking about things like climate change and some of the issues that are affecting our environment. I'm getting folks saying, texting me, hey, don't be texting me, folks, tune in. He's going to be, you know, getting into some things that might be considered controversial in terms of our environment and what we're doing to it, and some things that we might be able to do to help to curtail some of what we've done to it. You know, my perspective, and I know a lot of you feel the same way just from conversations that I've had with many of you, there's no coincidence. This whole pandemic thing, you know, at a very high, high level. It's just the planet saying, hold on, enough is enough. And it's about energy. And you know from listening to me over all the years, my regular listeners and those that tune from time to time, from my perspective and many of my mentors that I've trained under over the last 30 years, have the belief that everything truly is energy, and energy is everything. So, you know, as we've screwed up and just really gone amok, and I'm not pointing any fingers here because I know, you know, I probably participated that in my wild buck years before I kind of chilled back. But I think we've just taken this whole thing to another level in terms of just our egregious living and destroying the planet and our environment and what we see on television, the perversion. It's just become mainstream. No more hiding behind the garage, you know, to look at the little magazines or to you know, do whatever, you know, we did as kids. You know, this stuff is mainstream, walking down the street, you know, hey, and on television, prime time. So I think we've taken it to a level where the planet is vomiting, excuse the explicit language, that we've put to it, not just from a physical level, but from a mental and a spiritual level as well. And this is my belief on it, and we'll be having more conversations about that in the weeks and months ahead with some heavy thinkers. When I say heavy, because everyone that tunes into Progressive News is heavy, so that means you. We're looking for you to participate in that discourse, just to give your input on that. You know, how do you feel? Are things pretty much the same as they were 40 years ago or 30 years ago in terms of the lifestyles that we're projecting mainstream? So I'm looking forward to that. But we have in the wings, so to speak, this evening, Dr. Bruce Stein, and he's going to be tuning in with us in just a matter of moments, literally just a matter of moments. And he's going to be with us for maybe a half an hour or so. He has a very limited schedule as soon as he's able to tune in with us. But I'd be remiss if I didn't say, if you don't have someone with you now of a younger age, and I'm talking 20 years or younger, you know, maybe even 25 years or younger, then I would encourage you to get that. If you have someone in the house or the apartment or wherever you are of a younger age, you might want to do that, because the individual we have joining us this evening, and we're running just a little bit behind, truly is an individual that will enlighten not just adults, but with those fresh young minds, we really need to get them involved in this and what's going on. So if you can't reach out to a youth right now, make sure you go to the archives and just have them tune in to this particular podcast. Of course, our archives are, you know, recorded, but this is live. And with that said, hopefully we'll have time to take your questions. If we don't, I'm going to put our guest on the spot like I always do and hope that he'll be willing to come back if we don't impose on his time too badly. And with that said, I need to get on with this, as I was telling you about our special guest from National Wildlife Federation. And I know a number of you have even reached out and said, hey, you know, it's Earth Month, and you haven't had a NWF on in quite a while. What's going on? So by popular demand, we were able to, you know, to make those arrangements. And so not just were we able to reconnect, but at a high level. And with that, I'm saying the special guest that we have with us this evening, I'm really looking forward to him joining us from time to time, hopefully in the future, because it's just a special treat to have someone of this caliber. This evening, we're going to talk, of course, about climate change. When you talk about the environment, you know, that's always one of the first things that, you know, that folks key in on, what is it about the environment. But there's oh so much more to talk about in that vein. So this evening, we have Dr. Bruce Stein, Chief Scientist and Associate Vice President, National Wildlife Federation, joining us. And just a little bit of background. He's an author, conservationist, and author of numerous publications, by the way, on conservation biology, climate change, endangered species, and so forth. He served as a scientific advisor to various government agencies, including the Department of the Interior, and he's on the steering committee of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature's Climate Change Specialist Group. And his climate smart conservation techniques have been widely adopted by wildlife and land managers around the world. So I could go on, but I won't, because I really don't have much time with Dr. Stein this evening. So let's get right to this conversation, this discourse. And as I said, hopefully if you have questions, you know, press 1 on the dial. It's the dial-in number is 347-838-9142. Press 1 if you think you're going to have a question. If we have time, if we don't, we'll invite Dr. Stein to come back. But without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Bruce Stein. Dr. Stein, are you on the air?
I am. Great to be with you, Daryl.
Oh, wow. Thank you for being so patient with us. We had a little bit of a delay this evening getting going, but we're here, and we're here in number, and we're looking forward to this. It's been a while since we've had National Wildlife Federation. So thank you. Welcome. Looking forward to us, you know, re-solidifying our longstanding commitment. Before you were in the air, I was talking a little bit about National Wildlife Federation and the work that you've done. But I couldn't dare, you know, give it the justice that I know you can. So before we start, can you just share, because we have new listeners, and I'm pleased to say, every week, and some may not really know about National Wildlife Federation. So can you give us like just a brief primer about National Wildlife Federation, not to be confused with some of the other organizations like Greenpeace or some of those other ones out there, Sierra Club and those things, those other ones. But tell us about National Wildlife. How did it get started? And if you can, just a little bit.
Sure. Well, and it's a good time to be talking because obviously Earth Day was yesterday and Arbor Day is tomorrow. So we're kind of sitting right in the middle of in the springtime when, you know, even though we're all hunkered down due to the pandemic, you know, springtime is still a time of rebirth and when we appreciate nature and the environment. And National Wildlife Federation actually is about 80 years old, and it was founded in response to one of the during a period when we had a similar kind of environmental crisis, and that was during the 1930s, the Depression and the Dust Bowl. And at that time, there was a lot of concern about crashing waterfowl populations and other wildlife populations. And so it was during the Franklin Roosevelt's era that there was that people came together to ask what do we need to do to restore America's wildlife, and the National Wildlife Federation was born out of that initiative. And so we've been around for more than 80 years now, and we are the nation's largest conservation advocacy and education organization. We have nearly 6 million members and supporters around the country. We have state affiliates in virtually all states in the U.S. and several U.S. territories. And we really focus our work in a couple of major areas. We work to make sure that we can protect and restore the habitats that our wildlife and that we as people depend on. We work to make sure that we in state agencies and federal agencies are managing wildlife populations in ways that take advantage of 21st century techniques. And we work to reconnect people with nature. And so we spend a lot of time working with kids and helping kids as well as adults appreciate and understand nature. And so, for instance, you mentioned, you know, how we differ or can be distinguished with some of the other organizations people might know of. But one of the things we're best known for is publishing the Ranger Rick magazine, which is a way, it's been really a pathway for so many kids to become interested in nature and the environment. And so, you know, a lot of people know us from the Ranger Rick route, but we do all sorts of things.
Wonderful. Sounds like you kind of set the tone for nature and conservation. The website is, I usually wait till the end, but I know some folks have limited time, so I want to get that right up there. How can they get information about National Wildlife Federation?
Sure. The our website is nwf.org. For National Wildlife Federation. And there's a whole host of information that's available there. In fact, one of the things that we've done, because we do know that so many people are at home and young kids are out of school or, you know, at home trying to do distance learning, but we've actually made all of our Ranger Rick archives and related kids publications available free of charge online, so that, you know, this is our way of helping to give back and help make sure that, you know, even though we are all suffering through this pandemic, we can at least, you know, help to offer some resources for parents as well as kids to get through this.
Oh, that's fantastic. So they would just go to the website and they would be able to find the Ranger Rick series at the website itself?
That's right. And of course, we also have our grown-up publications. We publish National Wildlife Magazine. I don't want to say our adult magazine. Gives it a slightly different connotation. But
exactly.
There's a lot of great articles and wonderful photography that's published in National Wildlife Magazine as well, and that's available to view online too.
Oh, no, that's fantastic, because I love that. In fact, that was one of the ways going back when I first started doing radio when I was in New York. I was just sitting actually in a – all right, I don't want to take any time, but I'll take 30 seconds. I was sitting in the dentist's office, and I just picked up a magazine. And I just found myself enamored with it to the point where when, of course, they called me in, you know, I had to take it with me, and I just couldn't stop, you know, going through it. And so I said, I got to have them on my radio show. And that's kind of how we came together. So you're saying there's a link to the magazine on the website?
Yep. You can go and read the magazine online, see the photos. This particular issue is all about our Garden for Wildlife program. It's got some wonderful wonderful articles in there. There's an article on rare and endangered plant species, which is near and dear to my heart because I actually am a botanist by training. And so, you know, even though I work for an organization, you know, called National Wildlife Federation, of course, to me, you know, you don't need to have a backbone and a nervous system to be wildlife, plants or wild things as well. So I was really pleased that we've got a whole article in this issue on rare and endangered plants and articles on how you can make your garden more open and friendly to attract wildlife species like birds and butterflies.
What's the name of the magazine again?
National Wildlife. So just National Wildlife Magazine. Yep.
Excellent. Well, you and I were having some, you know, little discourse, and I've perused the website from time to time, and there were a couple of areas that I knew in our limited time I wanted to make sure that we touched upon. So the low fruit first, which is climate change. Now, this has been a heck of a run this last year I'll say at least the last year, did we actually have what would be called a winter? And so, I mean, there's stories about the poles melting. So give us your synopsis of what's going on with regard to climate change. And is what we're experiencing now, from your scientific perspective, reflection of that, or is it just a cycle that happens every 50 years or 30 years or something like that, or every 2 years? Give us the bigger picture of what's happening, please.
Yeah, sure. Here's the fact of the matter. We are in an unprecedented time. The Earth is currently warming at a faster rate than it has in millions of years, and so it's really warming at a faster rate than has ever occurred during human existence on the Earth. And we've seen the hottest annual temperatures over the last several years in the recorded observational record. We're seeing each month it seems the global temperatures are hotter than the year before. And so we know why this is happening. The reason it's happening is because burning fossil fuels and other things puts carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That carbon dioxide and methane, things of that sort, are what are called greenhouse gases. It's like the reason why when your car heats up on a sunny day, the sun rays come in, they warm it, and then the glass keeps that energy from going out. That basic, physical property has been known for more than 100 years, and the concentrations of carbon dioxide have been increasing since the start of the Industrial Revolution. So we're beginning to see the actual effects of global warming and climate change on temperatures, on increasingly severe hurricanes, bigger wildfires. This is not some cyclic thing due to sunspots or some of the other, theories that are thrown out there by folks that are in the business of denying the reality. As I like to say, the science of climate change is solid and clear. It's only the political science that's unsettled right now. And we know what's causing this. We know what we need to do, which is to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are going into the atmosphere. But obviously, there's concern about what the economic costs and consequences of that would be. And so the same kinds of voices that for so long denied that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer are out there denying that putting additional carbon dioxide and burning fossil fuels is leading to increasingly extreme weather and climate change. And I would say that, there obviously is a concern about what it will cost to reduce those emissions and get climate change, reduce the rate of climate change, hopefully begin to reverse this. But I would also say that we are going to begin seeing enormous economic consequences from the effects of climate change. You can only need to look at what happened during Hurricane Sandy and the huge economic costs of that, and that was made in part more severe by climate change, or the tremendous flooding that occurred in Houston during Hurricane Harvey, where the hot water of the Gulf, which was unprecedentedly warm, served as fuel for those hurricanes that just stalled out over Houston and provided torrential rains and flooding. So, the idea that ignoring climate change we're going to avoid costs is actually just the reverse. We're going to be seeing increasing costs and effects, not just on wildlife are already suffering, but increasingly on people and in our homes.
So you're saying that, and it's not rhetorical, because I know I host, I interview from the perspective of there may be a third grader in the audience. And I know that may aggravate some of the others, but that's just the way it is. So I'm going to ask a question that some may say, Darryl, please. All right, so here it goes. You're saying that the hurricanes, the I'm going to throw this in, the tornadoes, some of this extreme weather is related to climate change. This winter that wasn't a winter, I think we had two, I don't know if we had 2 inches of snow the whole winter. Are you saying those patterns will increase, like these amazing frequent hurricanes and tornadoes and windstorms?
So here's what we know. We know that as the earth warms, as the air warms, as the seas warm, that provides fuel, that energy provides fuel for increasingly strong and severe storms. Now, we're not saying that climate change creates hurricanes. In fact, there's a lot of research going into this. You know, will hurricanes become more frequent or less frequent? We don't know that, but what we do know is that they are becoming stronger and more severe. That's why we've begun seeing some of these hurricanes that start out as kind of a Category 1 storm, and people probably have heard of some of the recent hurricanes that all of a sudden pop up to Category 4 and 5 in an unprecedented amount of time. So the increasingly severe weather events are one of the hallmarks of climate change. Now, you mentioned tornadoes. Tornadoes is actually one of those things where it's not clear what the climate change signature on tornadoes is. So I want to be, you know, I want to be sure not to overinterpret the data. But we know that climate change is having an effect on increasingly severe hurricanes. We know that sea level rise, which is a byproduct of climate change, is creating a higher launch pad for the storm surge that those hurricanes are bringing in. We know that the severe droughts and multi-year mega droughts in the western U.S. are related to climate change and are having an effect on these massive wildfires. These sort of unprecedented long-term droughts are setting the stage for the wildfires. So again, the point isn't that climate change is creating these things, but it's making them more severe. I guess the analogy that I would use is a few years ago when you had the steroid scandal in baseball, and there were all those home runs being hit. So the steroids weren't causing home runs to be hit, but the steroids were increasing the frequency with which those ball players were hitting their home runs. And in the same way, climate change is increasing the probability of severity of many of the extreme weather events that we're seeing.
Let me ask a question while it's on my mind. This is a treat for me.
Sure.
You know, 30, 40 years ago, if not more, there was this concern with aerosol and the environment. Can you tell us, what was that link? What was that about?
Well, I'm not sure specifically but there was a couple decades ago, there was real concern about a compound called fluorocarbons that were basically in the aerosol cans that we were using, you know, the hairspray and whatnot. It was
exactly
kind of used
That's
as
what
a
I'm
propellant.
Referring to.
And what that was doing, it was these were long, live, persistent compounds that went into the atmosphere, and they were actually binding in a way that it was destroying ozone molecules. And so there's an ozone layer up in the atmosphere that's actually very important for screening out certain kinds of ultraviolet radiation. And if you don't have that screen, then more of that ultraviolet radiation comes down, and of course, UV radiation is one of the things that causes skin cancer. Anyway, there was a hole in the ozone layer that was developing, and we still have, to a certain degree, a hole in the ozone that forms over the polar region, but particularly the South Pole, I believe. But as a result of concerted government action and international action, there was a ban put in place on these fluorocarbons, these compounds, very effective. And we actually, you know, not only banned them, but we used some economics, some market forces to do it. And it was a huge success. And I'll also point out that at that time, it was something that got bipartisan support. You know, 30 years ago, environmental protection and rallying around these global existential problems was not considered a partisan issue. It was a human issue. And one of the things that's been so distressing over the last couple decades is that so many of our dealing with so many of our environmental issues, whether it's climate change or endangered species or water pollution, somehow has become a partisan litmus test. And that, you know, I just think is really unfortunate.
Yeah,
you know,
I would agree with that.
50 years ago, the first Earth Day back in 1970, you know, the environmental awakening that took place in the late 1960s, you know, with the burning of the Cuyahoga River and in Ohio and the oil spill off of Santa Barbara and other sorts of things, it really caused a national awakening. And in short order, under a Republican president and a Democratic Congress, you had the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, and you had passage of some of the seminal environmental legislation like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. When you look at our ability to deal with the big environmental issues today, and climate change is foremost among them, it's just disheartening that it has become really such a partisan divide on this.
Yeah, it's a shame. I was talking about that before you came on air, not just from an environmental perspective, but just from a societal perspective of how things have degraded. That's another program in itself, Doc, we're going to have to do at some point. Because, you know, truly, it's just the way things have just degraded in our society, including, you know, the whole political arena. But I'm glad you shared that with us, because what you've said is that it made a difference, the actions that were taking place. And I think that's amazing, just the science to see that, you know, we have discovered a hole in the ozone. I mean, how do you discover something like that? That's just, you know, it's just mind-boggling. I have so much respect for scientists. But then to say,
and back in those days, people did have respect for science. That's been changing, unfortunately.
That's one of those other degrading situations.
That's a different,
in our society.
Issue. Yeah, right.
It's true. We don't have enough children going into STEM. I'm telling you, don't get me started. If you listen to my show regularly, that's one of my soapboxes that I do in my monologue almost twice a month. But and maybe we can work together to do some work, some programs in the future on that. But the action that was taking place in terms of reducing or eliminating those fluorocarbons, it's made a really big difference, Dr. Stein?
It has made a noticeable difference. That's right, you know, a very measurable difference. And I think that it's widely viewed as a huge success of international diplomacy. And the United States played a leadership role in brokering the international agreements around that, you know. And so, and that's one of the other, you know, unfortunate things is that, you know, at the moment the U.S. has really abdicated a lot of its leadership on the international stage in terms of the major environmental issues of our time.
There we go again. It's like we can't get away from it. And that's why I say we're going to have to do some kind of collaboration on that, Doctor. I'm serious, and I'm kind of tongue-in-cheek, because this has to be, from my perspective, the things that we're going to talk about, and I know we just have a few minutes. Now, Dr. Stein, I'm going to have to ask you if you come back within the next 2 or 3 weeks, because we just don't have enough time. There's so much that, and I see my lines blowing up. I'm not going to be able to take questions. I'm going to stop for a moment. Is that something we can talk about offline, you coming back in the next, within the month? Or
yeah,
so?
we can talk about that. My travel schedule is kind of in a lull at the moment.
Oh, okay. I
As
wonder
most
why.
Everyone else is, yeah.
Okay, that's fantastic. So, because we're coming towards the bottom of the hour, but some of the things that we're talking about, you know, my perspective is, it's proven over these short years I've been doing what I'm doing here as a service. When I find that we revisit a topic, whether it's GMO food or whatever it is, vaccinations, controversial or not, as listeners become more educated, they tend to participate more, they tend to want to have more discourse, and they tend to talk about it more. And I always say this is a radio program supposedly not unlike, you know, the wonderful, great country we live in, and I mean that sincerely. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else, potentially wise at least, because we have some issues we're going through as a country, I believe. But it's a program that's for us, by us, and of us. And so we ultimately can make a difference. And so, and I'm saying that this is educational. And as our listeners become more comfortable with this dialogue, they'll tend to have that conversation across the fence or down the hall in the apartment or in the workplace. You know, I was just talking about fluorocarbons. And as that conversation starts to stir, and I always say energy is everything and everything is energy, there's a buzz. And everything is supply and demand. And as the people say, wait a minute, hold up, just like GMO, and I don't want to go off on that, but I'm very proud to say that I've had so many GMO advocates, national, international advocates on the program, even when we started, that I'm not going to take a lot of credit, but I'll take a fraction of a tenth of a credit, because we've had, you know, national initiatives to say, you know, write a letter, genetically modified food. We need to maybe talk about that at least label it. Give us the choice if we don't want to have it. And now you're seeing a lot of things. So I believe as people speak up, high fructose corn syrup was another thing that we did about 7 or 8 years ago. So if we can maybe have this kind of a discourse about some of the things that you're talking about and educating us on, and people are more comfortable, then maybe we can get a progressive movement, and I'm not saying progressive from a political perspective, left wing, right wing, I don't do politics. Folks that know me know I don't do that. So I'm saying progressive literally from that term, from a perspective of evolving as a society in terms, as opposed to regressing. So now with that said, if I can just touch upon one other topic or piece of a topic. As I was perusing the website, something that, you know, piqued my interest was not just the climate change piece, and we haven't peeled back the climate change, but for interest of time, we just kind of at a high level touched upon it, just to stimulate some thought for our listeners, because I know that I can feel the light bulbs coming on and the brains ticking. The other piece that I found interesting was combating invasive species. That was how it's labeled on your website. And there are things that that you talk about, such as identifying, preventing disease transfer between domestic livestock and native wildlife. That's one I want to touch upon in just a moment. Increasing the awareness of risk to fish and wildlife that's presented by the release of synthetic organisms, and then another one, protecting and, of course, restoring our fish and wildlife population. I mean, I'm not a big fisherman, but I believe it's a wonderful sport, and whenever I go, I enjoy it. but we have to protect that population from toxic chemicals and other kind of compounds and contaminants. So of those three things, because of the pandemic, I'm going to throw one at you. And every now and then I like to throw a curveball. Okay, listeners, I don't think we're going to be able to take questions. I see there, my engineer is saying folks want to ask questions. Hold off for just a moment, please, folks. I want to touch base. Give me some input about the link of this coronavirus and the whole wildlife conservation, because the few conversations that we've had, in email and verbally, there were a couple things that you said that I was like, whoa. So I'm going to hand the mic over to you and share with us your perspective as a scientist, a botanist, about the,
sure. Yeah.
The
core
of it, coronavirus.
Here's one thing your listeners should understand is that many of the infectious diseases that impact humans started out in animals, either wild animals or domesticated animals, and then at some point made a jump across that animal-human barrier. This is how AIDS started. Chimpanzees apparently were the original host. This is how Ebola occasionally infects or reinfects humans in Africa. This is how the SARS epidemic and virus started. And the novel coronavirus that's currently spreading across the globe apparently started in very much the same way. The novel coronavirus is very, very similar to viruses that exist in wild species of bats in China, specifically the horseshoe bat. And the best understanding at the moment is that somehow this essentially bat virus made the leap, or what's often called a spillover event, into humans. So a disease that starts out in animals and then ends up spilling over into humans is what's called a zoonotic disease. These things have been, occurring since time immemorial. And they are not only predictable, but they've been predicted. These kinds of pandemics, when they say who could have predicted this, there were actually a lot of people who've been working on this. And one of the main reasons for these spillover events is when people go in and disturb intact habitats, particularly in the tropics, go in and where you have commercial trafficking and trade in wildlife and where you have what are called these wet markets, where many different species of wildlife are being sold either live or freshly killed, and then there's opportunities for whatever disease agents or viruses they have to make that jump. That's what we suspect occurred in the novel coronavirus case. It's, again, when it was sequenced, it's most closely related to a virus in bats, but it may have actually come through a secondary host. There is an animal called pangolin, which is actually the most heavily trafficked, illegally trafficked animal in the world. And it's possible that, the pangolin served as a secondary host for this thing. And, many of the initial cases seemed to be associated with a wet market in Wuhan, China, that was one of these kinds of markets that did offer up, wildlife fish and wildlife for commercial purposes. And I would recommend to your readers, there's actually a fabulous book that was published probably 8 or 9 years ago called Spillover by David Quammen that talks about the history of just these sorts of spillover events, zoonotic diseases jumping to humans, you know, going through the history of things like malaria and AIDS and SARS and MERS, which is the Middle East virus where camels are the host. And it was very prescient to project that, you know, it wasn't a matter of if this would happen again, but when, and, here we are. So anyway, it's just important to note that although this is a tragedy of human suffering and economic devastation, it is at heart a wildlife conservation issue, because until we really shut down the illegal trade and commercialization of wildlife trafficking, you know, we're going to see this kind of thing happen again.
Interesting how you went down the list, and many, if not most, of these pandemic potential issues were animal-sourced. It's as though it's an environmental issue, these pandemic or these viruses. I mean...
Well, it's an environmental issue in the sense that, you know, I list these not to say that animals are bad and we should get rid of animals, but rather It has to do with humans interacting in risky ways with these wildlife populations. And also, increasingly, the evidence is that when people go in and they disturb and degrade these intact forest habitats, then that occasionally what happens is that, you know, you put people into exposure with some of these deadly diseases that make the jump.
As we wrap up here, we've gone over. You mentioned an animal. Was it pangolin?
Pangolin. PANGOLIN. Yeah, it's kind of like a scaly anteater type critter, and the scales are highly prized, especially in Asia. People think that they have some medicinal or almost magical power, and that's why this it's a mammal, but that's why this type of animal is so persecuted, sought after, and heavily trafficked. It's the black market. These pangolins on the black market are worth a lot of money.
So you said that they may have been involved with the Wuhan pandemic? We know that
the virus almost certainly originated in bats, and it's thought that pangolins may have served as the secondary or amplifying host, and so it's not for sure that they were involved in passing this on, but you know, it's one of the theories that's out there. Yeah.
So when you say secondary, in other words, the bat may have passed that on to the pangolin, and then the pangolin may have sort of transferred that
That is one of the possibilities. The other possibility is that it jumped directly from the bat species to humans. And again, that's not yet clear exactly how that occurred. But yeah, but
occurred.
those are two ways, that the evidence is not absolutely clear on either of those. But what is clear is that the molecular signature of the virus. It almost certainly originated in wild bat species. Yeah,
and that's the point. That's the main point. Because of the sort of the adulteration of these animals and interaction with humans. And I agree. I hope I didn't in any way infer that. You know, we're saying that these animals are bad. I think what we're doing is maybe we're invading their existence in ways that perhaps we should not. And that seems to be potentially problematic. By the way, as you close, David Quammen, I believe, Spillover.
David Quammen, Spillover. It yep. is a really a book that that is so prescient, you know, given our current situation.
Yeah, that came out in 2012. For our listeners, that's spelled Q-U-A-M-M-E-N. Familiar with that? It's called Spillover. Very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. You might want to just check that out, listeners. I think you'll find it very interesting how that many years ago. So this isn't anything new. Well, Bruce, I am, as much as I don't want to, I'm going to have to close the interview down in respect of your time, and also in consideration that I'm going to be asking you to consider coming back, and I don't want you to say no way. You kept me on. So, listeners, if you tuned in, I see a lot of folks still popping in. We have a question. I don't know if you want to just see if it's a simple question or not, if we want to just wait, Dr. Stein. We have one that's really pressing here. He's just pressing to get a question in or comment. Do you have another minute?
Sure. I've got
listener,
a couple
listener?
Minutes. Yeah.
All right, listener. We got a 718. You are on the line. 718-338. You are live. Hello? Going once? Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh,
I recognize his voice.
Mm-hmm. Ronald Crutcher, thank you for answering me. I wasn't along these lines. I'm very interested in the information that's being passed on. I want to show my appreciation for that immensely. But I'm off the topic, so I'll let someone else come in because this is a very interesting
We appreciate you, Ron. Thank you for being a regular listener. Ron is one of our historians, and I'm glad that you happened to tune in. And I have to reach out to you because it's been a while since you've enlightened us with some of your nuggets of knowledge. Mr. Crenshaw, are you okay? You and family in New York, everything is good?
Everything's perfect, so to speak.
Good.
As perfect
good,
as can
good.
Be, I should say.
Yeah, well, you hang in, do the right thing, self-quarantine.
Right.
I'm just glad because you're in the heart. You're in the epicenter there in New York, Ron.
Okay.
Mr. Crenshaw, one of our regular listeners and actually one of our special guests that come on from time to time from a historic perspective, historian out of New York. All right, Ron, well, we'll be back in touch. Thank you. I'm sure Dr.
Sure.
Stein
Thank
appreciates
you.
Your comments.
Okay, and I hope you got my email.
Yes, I did, definitely. So.
Great,
so
that's good.
Out of Ohio, my stomping ground. By the way, you mentioned Cuyahoga. You brought me back to my childhood, Dr. Stein, Cleveland. That's my stomping ground, and I remember those days when I was a lad, and that was all the talk of the country, the Cuyahoga burning, yes. So that's when that whole movement started, you're saying, Dr. Stein?
That's right. In the late 1960s, this confluence of the Cuyahoga on fire. Well, Rachel Carson, who published her seminal book Silent Spring earlier in that decade, but, there were just a whole of the smog. I grew up in Los Angeles, and so I grew up at a time when L.A., had just sort of choking smog there. And so all of those sorts of things coming together into that environmental awareness that really took off in the late 60s and then in April of 1970 with the first Earth Day. So, yeah.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take one more question out of Cleveland. I believe that's my area code. 216, you're on the air live. Hello? Going once? 216? It's in a 410? 216, you are on the air live. Okay, accidentally press 1. We're going to just, if you just can't hear me or something's going on with the phone, you have to catch Dr. Stein next time. Well, Dr. Stein, again, we so appreciate this information. Stop it. They're coming in hard and strong. I have another 216. Okay, maybe because the last one. You're on the air. Did you press 1?
Hello.
952, hello?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hello. Yes, yes,
can
I can
hear
you. How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
Good. Another Clevelander family. How are you?
Yes.
You have a question or comment for Dr. Stein?
Just a comment. I've missed a lot of the call, but
yes,
that's what I'm going to do. But I knew that this was a dialogue that I wanted to be a part of. This is such perfect timing. At first I was like, oh, my goodness, there's so much going on, and we're going to celebrate Earth Day. Well, all this is about is Earth Day. It's all about what's going on with our environment. This whole COVID thing is a result of our environment. You know, we have disrespected, abused, neglected our environment for decades, centuries. And we're now at a place where there's a reckoning. And I read recently about the North Pole, you know, disintegrating. You know, it's starting to melt. We know about that. We've been hearing about it for a while. And what's interesting about this period of time, and my hope is that people will take this time to really reflect. That's really what this gives us an opportunity. You know, when things happen, I always try to see the good in it. And there's a lot of potential good in this. And one thing is that we have an opportunity to think, to ponder, to muse, and try to understand why. They said that there is, for the first time in decades, the skies over L.A. are clear. And I never thought about it. They don't have the smog clouds. You know, that's the first thing you see. You fly into L.A. or out to California, you see that smog, and it's like, oh, my goodness. There's no smog cloud because there's no traffic. There are a lot of phenomena that are taking place now as a result of us not being on.
Well, I think your listener makes a really good point. I'm hoping that people will take this time when we're all hunkered down at home, sheltering in place, to think about what has been going on and what we might be able to do differently. I mean, I think that the kinds of changes that we're seeing in terms of smog clearing up in not just L.A., but apparently in India, where, you know, you have the worst air pollution in the world, suddenly people can go outside and breathe and see, and water, water clearing up, greenhouse gas emissions dropping down. But these are going to be short-lived, once things get going again, we're going to see those come back. But I'm hoping that people can take this time to think about how our relationship with the earth and the environment and how we are so absolutely dependent on it for human health, as well as our livelihoods, that we can really use this as a turning point.
Yes. I have one question, and then I'll be done. What do you think about algae blooms? I'm understanding that there's a possibility that the Great Lakes will see another algae bloom this spring.
So algae, and I'm glad you specified the Great Lakes, because we're also there have been serious algae blooms down in Florida as well the last year or so. But the Great Lakes, that has been a real problem, and there's a couple of contributing factors. One is that temperatures are increasing, so the water temperature. But the greatest factor is that we have nutrients coming off of agricultural lands, poorly managed farmlands and agricultural lands, running into the lakes, and then that's essentially the nutrients and food that the algae use, and it's become a huge problem in Lake Erie in particular. What we really need to see is we've done a great job in this country. I mentioned the Clean Water Act that was passed in the early 1970s. That act has done a fantastic job in reducing water pollution out of what's called point sources. So, you know, outflow pipes and things of that sort. But what the Clean Water Act has not done a very good job of is reducing and regulating water pollution that comes off of what we call non-point sources, that is the runoff from ag lands and forestry and even suburban lawns. And so we're going to continue to see water quality problems and algae blooms in the Great Lakes until we really get the farmers and agricultural community to take a more active stand in reducing that nutrient pollution that's running off of their lands.
Okay. And they are potentially poisonous, correct?
Well, the algae, there are certain of those aquatic algae that are, in fact, toxic for people, yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, and I appreciate you answering my questions.
Okay, great, thank you. Daryl, you there? I'm not sure where our host went.
Daryl?
I'm here. My glitch. My engineer kind of disappeared on me, and I'm trying to operate the board, so that was my bad there. I was listening, and I was trying to comment, and I'm like, why aren't they? And then when you said, what's happening to our host, I said, oh, why don't I turn on my mic? That would help. So I apologize, listeners. But I'm so glad that, you know, that our listeners tuned in and you got folks interested. And like I said, our lines just began to blow up, I guess. They started to get the announcement, Dr. Stein. So I see we have one of our horticulturists on the line. I feel so bad for her because she's one of our guests that we have every now and then on the program. Let me see. I think that is – I recognize that number. Ms. Dow, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Did you have a comment as Dr. Stein exits and maybe the next time he's on you can come on a little earlier? Did you have anything you wanted to say before he closes out? Because I know you're a horticulturist.
Well, what I want to tell everybody is you need to grow your own food and you need to make sure you freeze whatever you can from your harvest in the fall because the supply chains have all been interrupted. We will do fine now because our domestic farmers have excess produce, but we're going to have problems across the winter in terms of having good, healthy vegetables, fruit, whatever. So I want everybody to, even if you just grow salad in the window in a window box, everybody needs to grow some of their own food, learn how to preserve food like your ancestors did with mason jars and pressure cookers and stuff, even drying things. Try to, like, capture some of the skills of our ancestors because we do not know what's going to happen for the next year and a half. So we'll be fine now. Pardon me?
Dr. Stein?
Well, I don't know how our supply chains are going to weather this, but I think it's sound advice to grow as much of your food as you can, and obviously putting it away would be prudent.
Not to interrupt, Ms. Dow, but I know that your time constraint has got to be pulling on you now. So, Dr. Stein, listeners, and Ms. Dow, don't go away. Perhaps you can share some other things. But I've got to let Dr. Stein get to another engagement. Dr. Stein, thank you so much. We have been listening, for those of you who did tune in a little bit late, we have been listening and talking and having some discourse with Dr. Bruce Stein. Dr. Bruce Stein is the chief scientist and associate vice president of the National Wildlife Federation, author of numerous publications, conservationist. He's on the steering committee of the IUCN, He's just does so much work, and hopefully I haven't totally outworn the welcome, and he will be willing to join us. And I know now that the lines will blow up early now that you know who Dr. Stein is, and he's certainly a family member of Progressive News Weekly as far as we're concerned. Dr. Stein, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking this time out to join us.
Great. Well, thank you,
Darryl.
Darryl, it's been a pleasure to join you tonight. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I'll be in touch, no question, and looking forward to doing it again sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Great.
All right.
Okay,
so
good
again,
night.
All right, have a good night. So again, that was Dr. Bruce Stein, National Wildlife Federation, and as I said, if you came on the program late, as some of you said you did, you'll want to go to the archives. And, of course, the archives are blogtalkradio.com. And once you go there, I mean, once you type that in, you're going to type in a /Renford. So it's blogtalkradio/Renford. And once you put that in your computer, it's going to bring up all of my programs, Progressive News Weekly programs, going back 2 or 3 years, including some of the programs that Ms. Deborah Dow has been on before, and I'm hoping she's still on the line. Deborah, Ms. Dow, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Would you help us close out on some other tidbits on this Earth Week, if you will, of suggestions from a conservationist and horticultural perspective? And Ms. Dow, I'm going to reach out to you because it's been too long. It's been several months since you've been on. So, but would you be willing to share some things? I heard what you're saying about canning. How long does that last when you can vegetables? I was having a discussion yesterday about that.
Well, it depends, and I really can't answer that, but it doesn't last forever, but it'll definitely last a year or two. But
really?
What I want to say to people is that a lot of the stores now won't allow you to buy seeds, okay? They're saying they're non-essential. Whoever controls seeds controls the food. You really also have people who buy seeds and they've been sitting around the house for years. I want you to know that there were seeds that were found in the pyramids that actually sprouted and grew. So just because you may have some old seeds that your mother or your grandmother might have left around the house, give them a chance. Maybe they wouldn't germinate as quickly as seeds bought this year, but give them a chance. If you have a youth program or Sunday school or something, consider having a seed drive. Reach out to your entire congregation or membership and ask everybody to bring forth their seeds and try to do as much as you can to grow food. Now, there's one thing that's very interesting. The marijuana industry perfected growing food in closets. So now you can buy a closet with grow lights inside that you can put in a room in your house, plug it in, and grow all the salad you ever wanted. And the good thing, salad will mature in a month. You know, you can actually plant lettuce and start picking leaves off the lettuce in 3 weeks. Radishes mature in 20 to 30 days. And you can eat the tops. In fact, the tops of lettuce, of radishes are absolutely delicious. What you need to do is invest in a way to grow indoors if you can with grow lights. You don't need a lot of light for anything that doesn't make a flower. So greens, collard greens, kale can grow with a low light source. If you want to grow things like tomatoes, you're going to need a really good grow light system. But if something like cherry tomatoes, one plant would be all the tomatoes a family would need. So if you have 2 or 3 cherry tomato plants growing, you'd be amazed you can actually share. I always say that cherry tomatoes are the perfect plant for children because you have to pick them every day. And remember, with all things, they respond to need. So if you do not pick the fruit, the plant will not make more. Green beans, tomatoes, cucumbers. Pick them as soon as they're ready, and then the plant will give you more. So what you really need to do, and this is a very good thing for your children who are out of school, you know, agriculture is the ultimate STEM education. You can teach a child so much about life through teaching them how to grow their own food. I've also understood that children will eat anything they grow. You know, you may have a child who's a picky eater, but if they grew it, they're going to eat it. They're going to taste it. They're going to have a relationship with it. We've allowed a lot of these children to grow up on the so-called Happy Meal. That's why I wonder, in fact, I just found out recently that adults who are older who recover from coronavirus have much more aggressive antibody profiles than young people who recover. All kinds of reasons for this they haven't figured out yet. But we were not fed the things that these children have grown up on, and we also didn't have massive amounts of vaccinations impacting our immune system. So you really need to start changing what children eat, because the Happy Meal isn't going to give you a body that is going to withstand some of the stress of a lifetime. And it's very, very important that we realize that our food is our medicine. It is not entertainment. You know, it is not something frivolous that you do just for taste. You eat the most nutrient-dense food you can find. And that's the best message I can give anybody.
Thank you so much, Ms. Deborah Dow. We have been just so long overdue for you to join us. I will be in touch with you offline as well. To our listeners, especially those who called in, thank you so much for tuning in. Happy Earth Week. Do something, as Ms. Dow suggested, to make a difference. And if it's nothing but being conscious, go to the National Wildlife Federation website. Dr. Stein mentioned they have the children's books, and they have the they now for free have the actual magazine, the Wildlife magazine that's on the National Wildlife Federation, I believe. The website is nwf.org, and I love the magazine. So he's saying that just for this time period, the magazine, the copies are there free. It's called National Wildlife. That's the name of the magazine. And then they have the children's magazine that's up there as well. So let's make a difference, and maybe it'll just also help us kind of take our thought off of this pandemic thing. You know, we don't want to give that too much energy. Deborah was right on point when she was saying, you know, a lot of this we can do something about, focusing on our health, and with that, focusing on what we ingest. We are what we eat. As you know, as a nutritionist, a naturopath, you know, my focus is on natural approaches to wellness. I've worked with several doctors. I still talk with doctors. I talked with a couple this week and last week. Some are asking me, you know, Daryl, you know, need to talk with you about building immune. I have some, you know, specific patients who, you know, I need to do that with. Of course, I naturally have information. This is them speaking to me. But, you know, I'd be interested in some specific protocols for building immune. It's about building your immune system, folks. That is your best chance, right now at least, for prevention and treatment, actually, because they and not if they did come out with the treatment that I would say I'm here to say jump all over that, but they really don't even have a treatment as of yet. I know they were talking about the hydrochloroquine as something that's helped, and from what I've heard, you know, it's very something that can pull you out of a hole, but we don't know what those side effects are. So, folks, I can't say enough, just emphasizing what Ms. Dow said, especially with regard to growing your own, because there you're going to get the most nutrient-rich food that you can possibly get. So, again, thank everyone for tuning in. Stay safe. Protect yourself. By that, I would say the best thing you want to be is aware. Be aware of your environment. Be aware of what you're ingesting. Be aware of people that are around you. Be aware when you're outside, things that you're touching. And of course, anyone that comes near you. So with that said, my peace, my blessings go to you and all your loved ones. I pray that you all are well. Tune in next week when we're going to have a riveting program. Mr. Tony Grant will be returning, a research journalist, and he has some research. He's been doing that. Well, it won't even be about putting on your seatbelt. You're going to need the shoulder belt. You're going to need to really hold on because he's going to bring some information about things like viruses and this coronavirus that you have no idea more than likely about. And if you did, he'll probably have some layers on top of it. So try to tune in next week. Share that. And peace and blessings to you. Ms. Dow, thank you again for sharing that valuable knowledge that you did. And, of course, as I said, I will be in touch. God bless you. Let's all just, I guess I'll close out with just a prayer for the world. Prayer for the world. When I look at the dark.